Remember Devo? The new wave band with the matching outfits and the flower pot hats? They looked kind of like robots. They were big in the 80s, but the band's founders actually met earlier as students at Kent State University. They were there on May 4th in 1970 when the National Guard opened fire and killed four students during an anti-war protest. Those were dark times, and they helped form the philosophy behind Devo, the idea that humanity is regressing or de-evolving. One of the founders of Devo is Mark Mothersbaugh, and he still makes music. He's scored a bunch of Wes Anderson's films. But these days, he is also getting attention for his visual art. His work is the subject of a new solo museum show that's touring the country. And when Doug Gordon talked with Mark Mothersbaugh, he discovered that if it weren't for his nearsightedness or myopia, he might never have become an artist.
Mark, you have this new major exhibition at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Denver called Myopia. Why did you decide to call it myopia?
I was almost 8 years old. I'd been getting in trouble in first and second grade as being a problem child, and they didn't know what was wrong with me. They thought I was crazy or something, I think. I was getting disciplined all the time. And then near the end of second grade, I got diagnosed as legally blind. Nobody had realized that I couldn't see past 6 inches. So I got my first pair of glasses, and I saw clouds, and I saw things flying in the sky, birds, and I saw smoke coming out of chimneys. All for the first time, I saw the school I went to. I saw what a house looked like. I saw the whole housing development I lived in, kind of, because we were at a hill. It was amazing. It was such an intoxicating event that I just started drawing the things I'd seen. And one of the things that really impressed me was trees, partly because I'd never seen a tree past the trunk, the part that you run into when you're playing in my front yard when I was a kid. I saw what they look like at the top of a tree, and I just thought that was an amazing thing. So I was drawing trees, and this teacher that had spent the year disciplining me and being totally frustrated with me said the first nice thing a teacher ever said to me. She said, "You draw trees better than me." So I went home that night, and I dreamt I was going to be an artist.
Yeah. Let's talk about your postcard diaries. Can you tell me a bit about them?
Back in the early 70s, you know, it started because of my vision being really hard to use perspective on big pieces of art. I would do my drawings small first, and then if I saw something I really liked, I could enlarge it. And so I was doing all of these postcard-sized drawings, and then somewhere in the early, mid-70s, I realized they were actually kind of my diary. I was kind of creating a diary. So I started saving them. I would save them in a stack, and when I got 100 drawings, I would put them in a binder and then put it on the shelf. So now it's 35 years later or more, and there's like about 350 of these books now.
And 30,000 postcards?
It's more than 30,000 at this point.
Do you have a favorite one that you can describe?
A favorite one?
Yeah, or one.
Out of 35,000 drawings?
Yeah, I asked the tough questions, Mark.
Yes. I did a sculpture in the last 3 or 4 years. It was a giant ruby. Someone let me carve it into custard.
Mm-hmm.
The first drawing I did of it with these custardy kind of poo piles, you know, kind of looking like custard out of a custard machine, had eyeballs.
Do you ever go back and look at the older ones to try and get a better understanding of yourself, since they kind of serve this autobiographical diary purpose?
Well, this museum show has kind of forced that on me. I mean, there were thousands and thousands of drawings I never looked at since the 70s or the 80s or the 90s. Then I had to go back and look at these things again. It was kind of interesting how your paranoias and your nightmares and your dreams and your expectations and your optimistic moments and your lyrics and your drawing style change as you get older. So it was kind of interesting to get to do that again, because a lot of it I looked at and I said, man, I was really a jerk. And then some of it I look at and I really love it. When I did most of this, I'd never intended for there to be an audience. I didn't censor myself. I let it be very kind of wherever the drawings wanted to go. And some of it was very stream of consciousness and kind of crazy when I look back at it. And I realized how things like having kids make you want to be a better person. And it changed my art, too. It made my art look different.
Yeah. Let's talk about Beautiful Mutants. This is your series of mirror image photographs. Tell me about them.
I've had a long time fascination with symmetry, and especially with human form, because humans, although we have two eyes, two ears, a nose in the middle, a mouth in the middle, two arms, two legs, two feet, we're not really as symmetrical as a lot of things in nature. Insects are usually far more precisely symmetrical than us. And if you slice a human down the middle and copy the one half and flip it over, the interesting thing I found out, especially in portraits, is that humans tend to have one half of their face. If you flip it and make it one face that way, there tends to be a side of every human that's a little more innocent and maybe sometimes angelic and oftentimes pretty or more aesthetically beautiful. And then there's a side that's darker. There's a side that looks like your dark side, your malevolent side. And they're both there attached together all the time in your life, in real life. But you never see them as separated unless you purposely split them and flip them over to make these totally symmetrical faces, which become disturbing. Even the pretty ones are disturbing.
Does it vary? Do you use the beautiful side or the malevolent side, or does it depend on the individual picture?
I use them both usually, and I tend to mix them up a little bit. If I have a gallery show, you have to look around to find the matches.
They're very beautiful and eerie, and many of them strike me as kind of a cross between the work of Deanne Arbus and David Lynch, and maybe even in some of them a kind of a hint of H.P. Lovecraft. And they reflect your interest in symmetry and mutation. What is it about symmetry and mutation that you find so intriguing?
I think when I was a kid, being legally blind and having to wear these glasses that look like pop bottles, I think I felt like a mutant. But like also, I think I came to the conclusion early on that I was going to embrace my mutation. I was going to embrace my weakness, and I was going to let it make me be a stronger person, be a stronger artist.
Yeah, and that makes me think of what the curator of your myopia exhibition, Adam Lerner, says. He says that you believe mutations define the essence of originality.
Early on, Devo, we were asked if we had a motto. Our motto from the beginning was, choose your mutations carefully.
Exactly, yeah. Have you ever tried to apply the symmetrical mirror effect that you use in the Beautiful Mutant series? Have you ever tried to apply it to your music?
Yes. I wrote music for a film called Royal Tannenbaums. I wrote this kind of nice, cute little bouncy piece of music. When we did the next film, the same director, Wes Anderson, was Life Aquatic, and there's a scene where Bill Murray, he's like this loser version of Jacques Cousteau. They haven't made any good movies. They haven't had any good finds. He's really proud of his boat. And there's one moment in the film where Bill Murray goes, let me tell you about my boat. And then it cuts to a giant elaborate cutaway that Wes built at the Cinecittà stages in Rome. And Wes said, can you make me a piece of music for this scene that's kind of like the scene with Angelica and Gene Hackman was like in Tannenbaums? And I said, sure. So I wrote a couple sketches for him and I played them for him. And he goes, no, those don't really do it. And so I wasn't sure what to do, and I was busy every day. I would be at work at Mutato, but in my head I'd be thinking about this box of old photographs I had and how I was going to mutate them that night. I held up a piece of music that was the music that Wes liked from Royal Tannenbaums to a mirror and played it in reverse. And so I came back the next day and recorded it that way, and he came into the studio and he listened to the piece of music from Royal Tannenbaums. It was called Scrapping and Yelling. I played it backwards and changed the instruments up a little bit to match a different feel for a different movie. But he went, that's it. That's perfect. So it was kind of interesting. I waited until we finished recording it before I told him that you already own that music. Facing the other direction.
That's a great story. I got to ask you about these very elaborate and beautiful, almost kind of Rube Goldberg-esque sculptures, which you call orchestrions. And the first one I think you made was based on bird calls, and it's called Mechanical Aviary.
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
I collect a lot of musical instruments, and I collect a lot of musical sound makers. At one point, I was collecting bird calls, and I had, I don't know, like 150 bird calls. Some of them were over 100 years old, and they were definitely from around the world. And I was doing some pieces of sound conceptual music for Wes Anderson's movie Moonrise Kingdom. And he sent me a piece of footage where there was two kids running through the woods and there was no sound on the film he sent me. And it seemed so eerie and odd to be watching these two kids in this big woods, you know, with leaves and trees, and they're running through it and there's not a single sound. And so I just started playing around with some of the bird calls while I was watching it. Then I became distracted and forgot about the movie, and I started playing with making rhythms out of the bird calls, and I started coming up with stuff that I really loved. I thought, wow, this is really hitting on something. But you couldn't sit there with a box of 40 or 50 bird calls in your lap and play anything with any kind of precision, or you couldn't get them in real time. You couldn't have three or four things overlapping. So I had come across this kind of crazy, interesting guy. He built orchestrions for amusement parks. He thought what I was doing was kind of crazy, but he was perfectly suited for building mechanisms that could cranks for turkey calls. It could tap little leather sacks gently for little peeping noises. And he helped me come up with all these different little miniature machines. And so we put together a machine with about 60 of those, the best of the bird calls. I'm able to control it with a keyboard, and I can write memory onto a memory chip and play music that I write for this thing. I call it a bird call aviary.
Adam Lerner, the curator of your Myopia exhibition, has said, "Mark Mothersbaugh himself is the work of art. Art is not about what you make, it's about how you live." So this raises the question, how have you managed to live such an artful life?
I don't know. You know, now, I don't know. I am who I am, and I've always been that, and I've been true to it. And I can say that some of it is really, you know, it's hard, but some of it, I was lucky too, you know? I was really lucky. I was part of an art group. Something about what we did, the music that we did, attracted the attention of people like David Bowie and Brian Eno and William Burroughs and Timothy Leary. And I just met all these interesting people through my art, and I never thought about going somewhere else.
It's lucky for us. And you have that great line, I know, about Devo is kind of the thinking man's Kiss. I love that line, and it raises the question, does that mean that Kiss is the stupid man's Devo?
I'll let you say that.
Okay, which I just did. And we'll see if it makes the final cut.
It's a beautiful world for you. For you. For you. It's not for me.
Mark Mothersbaugh talked with Doug Gordon. Mothersbaugh's solo exhibition, Myopia, is currently at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Denver. It'll travel to 5 other cities, but you don't have to wait that long. You can check out Mark's work on a slideshow on our website at dtbook.org.